Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
John Dingell Sr. went to Washington in 1933, representing Michigan's 15th district. He introduced a proposal for national health insurance in his first year and every year after that until he died in 1955 at Walter Reed Hospital. His son took over his congressional seat and his political crusade.
A bill for comprehensive health reform was first introduced by John Dingell Sr. in 1943. 65 years later, his son continues to introduce that same bill at the beginning of each session.
John Dingell Jr. is now the longest-serving member of the House. His family has argued for health care reform for 77 years.
This is perhaps Dad's single greatest unfinished business remaining.
That's Dingell in an interview with CBS News. Today, we'll ask the Dean of the House how it feels to be so close to finishing the business that his father began. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 19th. You know, you got to wonder what it's like to be close to finishing something that's taken 77 years.
Indeed. Let's get a check of the top morning's news stories. And the healthcare reform is right there in the top. House Democrats, and Dingell Jr. is one of them, are getting ready for a Sunday showdown on healthcare reform. They've been adding last-minute sweeteners to the bill, including insurance subsidies, a $250 rebate to help seniors pay for drugs. Also gone is the extra $100 million in Medicaid funds for Nebraska. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says Democrats are ready.
I think health care is going to pass the House on Sunday. I believe shortly it will pass the Senate, and the president will be able to sign all of it into law.
President Obama is rounding up the undecideds for one-on-one visits, and he's got a rally planned today in Virginia. He's postponed a trip to Asia until the summer.
For the long view on health care reform, we're joined now by the longest sitting congressman, Representative John Dingell, Democrat from Michigan. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have been proposing health care reform every year since 1957. You've seen pushes for health care reform before. Is it really going to pass this time, do you think?
Yes, it's going to pass because it must. It eliminates abuses like pre-existing conditions or denying people coverage. It will reduce the budget deficit by over $100 billion in the first 10 years and by over $1 trillion in the second 10 years. It will cover 32 million people who desperately need the help. It is a good bill, and it is a tremendous first step.
Okay, we're going to get more from you, Congressman John Dingell, in just a moment. Stay with us.
As one overhaul comes to a head, there's another one on the horizon in Washington. A bipartisan proposal to revamp the nation's immigration system was unveiled yesterday, requiring illegal immigrants to admit they broke the law before they could gain legal status, and requiring all U.S. workers to carry a national identity card to prove they are eligible to work. President Obama calls it a good first step, a good starting point, he said. We're talking this morning about today marking the 7th year anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. We earlier spoke with Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and he told us the legacy of not finding weapons of mass destruction is good news for any future rogue state.
There's much more skepticism about everything the United States government says, which probably gives the Iranians, as a perfect example, perhaps more leeway than they otherwise might have.
We're looking for your views here. What does it feel like in 2010 to have been at war in Iraq for 7 years? We're accustomed to war in America these days. Tell us what that means to you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our site, thetakeaway.org.
Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are mixed. The Dow will start at 10,779. The S&P opens at 1,165. And the NASDAQ opens at 2391. Coming up, a really fascinating science story, a recent discovery of mummies in China that look like Europeans. We're going to explore the mystery of the mummy.
It could be actually the first season of Lost discovered out there in the deserts of China. In a few minutes, more on healthcare reform with Representative John Dingell Jr. of Michigan coming right up.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
We have the bill, the House version at least, of health care reform legislation. It is public. The clock is ticking down towards Sunday when we're going to get a vote. And you know, John, Todd Zwillick is also ticking down on that clock as he waits for the vote to come through.
A bill he's actually read.
The entire thing, word for word. He's actually going to be tweeting all of the vote whipping today, all through the weekend. You can follow Todd Zwillick's tweet feed on our site, thetakeaway.org.
Meanwhile, we've got three Michiganders. To talk about
we do
it, right?
have three yeah. Michiganders in the House
yeah.
to talk about this bill that's going to cost $940 billion. You're one of them. You lived in Michigan.
I was in the 5th District, Republican District, Gerald Ford's old district.
Right. I actually still own my home in Grosse Pointe Park, and we have Representative John Dingell with us, a Democrat from Michigan. He is the longest sitting congressman, the dean of the House, and obviously the longest record of advocating for health care reform. It's a family business for you. Congressman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
So this was a huge issue for your father up until his death. And I'm wondering, what did your dad say to you about health care?
Well, Dad was an old tubercular. He was sent west to die. But fortunately, his life was saved at Union Printers Home from almost assured death from tuberculosis. At that point, he became not only a great social activist, but he became keenly aware of the need for health care for our people. And this was one of the principal goals of his life. And he was one of the major authors of Social Security and over 100 amendments to that particular law.
You know, the health care bill that you're going to be voting on Sunday is quite different than your dad's vision of it. He obviously proposed a single-payer system. I'm wondering, how different is this bill from your dad's vision?
Well, it's very different than Dad's bill. It's very different than my bill. But it's a very good bill, and it's a long stride forward. We have kept the exchanges, which is important. It will cost $940 billion, but the deficit reduction of it in the first 10 years is going to be $138 billion. And it is going to save over $1.2 trillion in the second 10 years. And it is going to cover 32 million Americans who no longer have care. It's going to eliminate all manner of abuses by the insurance companies, including using pre-existing conditions to deny people coverage, cancellation of policies because of health failures, and all manner of other things. And it is going to provide a lot of immediate benefits, like closing the donut hole for Part D recipients, and it's going to do something else. It's going to see to it that Medicare is protected and that the life of Medicare is extended by 9 years.
Okay, well, you know, but in all this political wrangling and the back and forth, some things were lost that I know were near and dear to your heart. What things got dropped out of the bill that you think should have stayed in or maybe have a chance of coming back in future years?
Well, obviously, I want a single-payer system. But I also want to cover every American, so I'm willing to give that up for that and for the assured possibility of passing legislation that's going to cover 32 million Americans and that's going to stop the tremendous increase in health care costs. As you know, health care costs have doubled in the last 10 years. They will double in the next 10 years. It will cost American people, the average family is going to be paying $25,000 for health insurance in 2019. So there is urgent reason to pass this because businesses are going broke. There's $1,600 worth of health care in every automobile, and none of our foreign competitors pay that cost. So health insurance is one of the things that broke the American auto industry and that broke the American steel industry and put them both in bankruptcy.
Representative Dingell, I have to ask you about, because you have served so long and because your father came from a tradition in Congress, there's certainly been a change in tone in debate and the political conversation in Washington since you began in Congress. You saw some measure of this when Henry Waxman unseated you from your chairmanship of the Committee on Energy and Commerce. And there's been a huge backblow from the American public at some of the rancorous fighting going on in Washington. What do you think about this? Do you think that Congress is more dysfunctional than ever?
Well, it is not the Congress. It is the Senate. The House has 300 bills and more sitting over in the Senate, all of which are important and which need to be passed to benefit the American people, that are just sitting there because of Republican opposition to the legislation. The Republicans are using the same strategy they did in 1994. Stop all legislation, defeat the health care bill, and then take control of the Congress. And so that is the situation. Of course, we have people like the Tea Party folk who are passing around information as to how you disrupt meetings, how you treat and abuse and disrupt meetings by members of Congress with their people.
But, Congressman, I'm wondering if in hindsight, with all the experience that you have, it would have been better for you to manage this bill in the House rather than Henry Waxman. You've got more experience than Waxman. Waxman wanted single payer, you want single payer, and you've got way more experience than Obama.
Well, thank you for those kind words. But remember, I am oriented towards a result. And my personal affairs are of little importance to the country, but getting major problems like health care solved is a matter of the utmost urgency, because failure to address this is going to destroy the country. In the year 2080, health care costs are going to equal the gross domestic product of the United States if we don't do something about it.
Okay, Republicans are saying, though, that without Republican support, that this bill is being pushed through, forced upon the American public, and that Democrats are going to pay for it in the next election. What do you have to say to that? Are Democrats going to end up paying the piper for, as the Republicans describe it, pushing this through?
My dad taught me that you do what is right and you go home and justify it to the people, and that they will take care of you. I think if you look at the polls, you will find that almost every individual component of this legislation is supported by people. There have been a tremendous number of lies and a lot of outrageous behavior about it. They told us how it was going to cause us to pull the plug on grandma, how there were death panels, both of which were outright lies.
Okay, well, we'll see. Good luck with the House vote on Sunday. Representative John Dingell, the Dean of the House, 27-term congressman representing Michigan's 15th district. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some other stories this morning.
Complex and maybe a little controversial story in the news this morning. A former top United Nations official says Pakistan arrested senior Taliban members last month in order to deliberately spoil secret United Nations talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Former UN envoy to Afghanistan, Kai Eid, told our partner the BBC that the UN had been having secret peace talks with the Taliban since the spring of last year. The Taliban withdrew from those talks after the Pakistani arrests. Pakistan has denied the allegation. In Florida, the third largest public hospital system in the nation has come up with an emergency plan to keep it running until the end of September. Miami's Jackson Health System plans to cut more than 600 positions and delay debt payments. But treasurer of Miami-Dade's Public Health Trust, Marcus Lapchick, says told NBC News the plan is just a temporary fix.
It's a very good mandate, a very painful one, but we do need afterwards to address the long-term sustainability of the business model.
Lapchick says the system's deficit for the year stands at $230 million, largely due to a high number of uninsured patients.
In Chile, a scientist says aftershocks from last month's massive earthquake will go on for at least a year, at least 45 tremors in the next month alone, he predicts. And finally,
born on the mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free.
Farewell to a familiar face. Fess Parker, the man who played Davy Crockett, has died of natural causes at the age of 85 at his home in California. The Davy Crockett Show debuted in December 1954. John, did you have a coonskin cap?
No, but I remember Fess Parker, that's for sure.
That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Fought single-handed through the Indian War, till the Creeks was whipped and peace was in store. And while he was handling this risky chore, made himself a legend forevermore. Davy.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. You know, every Friday we take a look back, right, at who's had a good week, who's had a bad week. And I'll tell you who had a great week, Katie Spots.
I know, I'm not familiar with Katie.
Katie rode a boat by herself 2,817 miles across the Atlantic. She finished on Sunday, and at 22 years of age, she's the youngest person to ever do that, to cross the ocean alone in a rowboat. She's back on dry land now and joins us from a hotel room in New York City. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
So, congrats. First of all, yeah, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What motivates somebody to do something like this?
Well, the purpose of this row, it was a row for water to raise funds and awareness for safe drinking water projects. So there's a billion people without access to it, and I wanted to do as much as I can to help and do something about that.
So what are the biggest challenges in doing something like this? Is it sleep deprivation? Is it not being able to, like, see somebody's face? Being alone for that long? The quietness? What's the hardest part?
Boredom was a real issue, but I think sleep deprivation certainly took its toll on me. As if rowing 10 hours a day isn't difficult enough, doing so on a boat where you're constantly being hit by waves and waking up in the middle of the night, that really, really made it much more difficult.
But, you know, one thing that kind of separates you from some of the others who have achieved this feat was that you actually were able to stay connected, at least over the internet, right? You were able to send emails, you were blogging while you were rowing?
People were able to follow along pretty much the whole way across. I had a tracking unit where people could see where I was at any given moment, and then an email account which enabled me to do the blog postings.
How many miles per day?
About 30 to 40 miles a day.
Oh, man.
I mean, this is a great week for you because, number one, you're back on dry land, right? And you can talk to people face-to-face.
Yeah, it's good to talk to something other than fish, that's for sure.
I bet you really understood the preciousness of fresh water being surrounded by salt water for all that time.
Yeah, to get water out there, I had a desalinator, which converted the salt water into drinking water. But that is one of the biggest equipment failures out there, is the desalination unit.
So Katie, you'd say you've had a pretty good week, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'm just starting to feel human again. I mean, everything's a wonder at the moment.
Well, let's hold on to those vibes, Katie, because, you know, every week we look at who's had a good week, who's had a bad week. Sandra Bullock, you know who Sandra Bullock is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she had a fabulous week winning the Oscar, you know, like a week ago, but this week was a very bad week for her, right?
Yeah.
You know, she learned about her husband's infidelity. I want you to just hold on to these good vibes and don't do anything drastic over the next week, all right? All right, our friends at The Week magazine have found a few other folks for good week, bad week. Celeste?
Well, Tiger Woods, we don't know if he's going to have any good weeks ahead, no. But he did make it a good week for CBS Sports and for the PGA. He announced that he will appear in the Masters next month.
I think that Tiger has acknowledged that he betrayed his family, and that's a personal issue that he's got to work out. I hope they've worked it out. I'm sure he's going to still be a terrific golfer.
That's President Barack Obama, of course. Good week for golf, possibly good week for Tiger, but it's a great week for CBS Sports. A record number of viewers are expected to watch one of the most highly anticipated returns to sports ever.
So, Katie, how sore are your arms right now?
Well, actually, ocean rowing, you kind of use your back and legs as a source of power. So
you have no problem picking up a golf club?
No.
Well, here's a bad week. Get an assessment of this here. Florida authorities say that a 23-year-old woman from Indianapolis decided to take a nap in her parked Jeep when a Panama City Beach tow truck came to remove her vehicle. Can you kind of figure out what's going to happen next? Yeah, the woman woke up inside a closed tow yard. She found a hammer and bolt cutters and cut her way out and promptly told the police of her situation. Bad week for her and the tow truck drivers, both, right? Did you wish you had a tow truck out in the water there for a while?
I mean, I love to challenge myself, but there were certainly moments I would have given anything to be back on land.
All right.
That's who had a good week and a bad week, according to The Week magazine. We embrace your suggestions on who had a good week or a bad week. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Even as if you're going across the ocean in a rowboat, you can still call us or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can see the full good week, bad week feature in The Week magazine that's on the newsstands.
Katie Spots, you win good week, hands down,
Absolutely.
For sure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
For our last takeout, we hear from you, our listeners. We've been holding a sort of census, you'd call it maybe a Rorschach test. You open your census form. What's your first reaction when you look at all those categories?
This is Sandra in New York. We are the category in the census for my granddaughter. Her mom is white, her dad is black, African-American, and there's not a category. Doesn't make sense to me.
My first reaction upon opening my envelope this morning is, wow, I'm offended. There seems to be some attempt to address various races by origin, but there only seems to have been an attempt to do that for Hispanic, Latino, or Asian, but zero attempt to make a distinction between origins of black or white.
If you want to explore the reasons for that or give your reactions, reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and follow all of our census coverage at thetakeaway.org.
You know, our listeners, they not only give us their opinions, but generally they offer advice as well. And there's actually a good piece of advice from a listener for that caller we just had about saying where's the category for her granddaughter.
This is Nance Cunningham of Oklahoma City. And when I opened my census form and got to the part about race, I was very happy to see that people could check more than one box. I hope a lot of people do, but I wish that those letters were in bold because I think some people will miss it.
I think the lady missed it earlier. You can actually, for your granddaughter, mark both white.
You can write in human.
African American.
You can write in human.
Is that what you do?
Well, no, that's what one of our listeners did too when they contacted us at thetakeaway.org. You know, I think what we've been learning this week is that the census isn't a document about complete egalitarianism. It's about identifying individual groups to channel federal resources to them.
Absolutely.
So there are reasons to be discriminatory, but it does seem uncomfortable sometimes when you open those forms.
It does. And another thing which may be uncomfortable to people is this anniversary. You know, as we've been talking about, today is the 7-year anniversary since the beginning of the Iraq War, which means that a lot of people are now accustomed to living with war. And we're wondering, what does that feel like for you? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our site, thetakeaway.org. What does it feel like to now be being used to being at war?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. So where were you 7 years ago today? Maybe you can't remember, but two soldiers from Iraq who documented their time in that war know exactly where they were 7 years ago today. They're going to talk with us in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. In the past 20 minutes, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer says he doesn't believe Democrats will lose control of the chamber if they muscle their health care reform bill through Congress. He acknowledges they may not have the votes yet, but tells CBS News this morning,
"We think members are going to conclude by Sunday this is the bill that does what we said we would do, and they're going to pass it."
Incentives are being added to attract more votes. Meanwhile, Republicans are doing anything they can to stop the bill. Senator Tom Coburn says he'll find out about any private deals Democrats make in the run-up to the vote.
If you think you can cut a deal now and it not come out till after the election, I want to tell you that isn't going to happen. And be prepared to defend selling your vote.
The Congressional Hispanic Caucus, meanwhile, threw their support behind the bill yesterday, the same day a bipartisan proposal to revamp the nation's immigration system was unveiled. That would require illegal immigrants to admit they broke the law before they could gain legal status, and it would require all U.S. workers to carry a national identity card to prove they are eligible to work.
In Moscow this morning, a quartet of top international leaders is condemning Israel's decision to build housing in disputed East Jerusalem. They're calling for a freeze on all construction. The group of leaders, made up by the U.S., the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia, also called on Israel and the Palestinians to restart peace talks soon. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
The quartet believes these negotiations should lead to a settlement negotiated between the parties within 24 months.
But while world leaders were urging peace, this is the sound from the Gaza Strip. Israeli warplanes attacking targets after a rocket strike by Palestinian militants on a southern Israel killed one person. Here at home, more American children are becoming obese at an earlier age. Studies show more than 7% of boys and 5% of girls are classified as extremely obese. And gas prices have hit their highest level in 2 years. The average price per gallon is up 19 cents in the past 2 weeks. Let's take a look at the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are mixed. The Dow will start at 10,779. The S&P opens at 1,165. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,391. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Now that conflict has come, The only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures, and we will accept no outcome but victory.
George W. Bush remembers where he was 7 years ago today. He was, of course, president, announcing the beginning of the war in Iraq. I remember where I was 7 years ago. I was actually in intensive care at the Mayo Clinic. My mother was actually near death. I watched all of the coverage on hospital video screens.
Which are always so great.
Indeed. But where was Stanley McChrystal 7 years ago, the commander of forces in Afghanistan?
He was
actually running the briefings at the Pentagon. He was assigned to run the Iraq briefings at the Pentagon 7 years ago. Now, of course, he's commanding forces in Afghanistan. And General David Petraeus, of course, something of a hero of the war in Iraq a few years after it began, was commanding the 101st Airborne 5 Corps, part of the actual invasion itself. Matt Gallagher, former Army captain. You remember where you were 7 years ago today?
I do. I was in my college dormitory drinking some beer and wondering if that was going to be my future, and it turned out to be.
And you ended up in Iraq at what point?
I was there 2007 through 2009.
And Mike Scotti, former Marine First Lieutenant, you served in Afghanistan and Pakistan well before the Iraq War. Do you remember what you were doing 7 years ago today?
7 years ago today, I was on my way in, crossing the border from Kuwait into Iraq, and ended up being a long trip up Route 7, which was an interesting convoy.
Something that Mike Scotti, a former Marine First Lieutenant, documented in the new movie Severe Clear, Uncertainty, Chaos, Disorder, This is War. And I looked at a copy of your film last night and this morning. It's an amazing amalgam of documentary footage and really sort of home video footage. Did you know what you were making at the time you were shooting down Route 7 there?
I did not. Actually, it was really a video diary that was going to be used for notes for a book that I was going to write. And Christian Fraga from Cirque Productions, who is the director of the film, basically saw the vision, saying, you know, the story needed to be told. And without those guys, the film would never have been made. So.
Here is a clip of Mike Scotti in Severe Clear, of some footage taken back in 2003.
If we don't tell our own story, who will? The media? Yeah. There are a bunch of journalists around, but I wouldn't call what they're reporting back home news. It's more like PR. Forget about taking Saddam out. Just going to the bathroom these days is a major operation. With the winds blowing, we have to line up and hold each other like a bunch of schoolgirls so nobody gets lost while taking a I guess that would be hard to condense into a neat little soundbite for the press.
Mike Scotti there expressing a certain amount of contempt for the media in his movie Severe Clear, Uncertainty, Chaos, Disorder, This is War. Matt Gallagher, you did write a book, Kaboom, Embracing the Suck in a Savage Little War, is your effort to document your experiences there, right?
It was. It started originally as a blog back in 2007 when we got there, with the shift to counterinsurgency and just kind of trying to explain what that meant tactically to people back home for those of us on the ground.
And you really were embracing a doctrine, dealing with an Iraq that was much different than what Mike Scotti found when he first headed up Route 7. What did you find when you first arrived in Iraq?
Well, that's absolutely a totally different experience. Just dealing with the locals and engaging them on a personal level was far less kinetic than Mike probably went through.
What do you mean kinetic?
Blowing stuff up, essentially.
But it was still challenging, right?
Oh, absolutely. Instead of focusing on immediately killing the bad guys, it was a grander strategic movement to cut off the insurgency through the populace and by building up Iraq with electricity and just civil projects and showing the Iraqis that we were their friend, and that was the best approach.
But maintaining a connection between the Iraqis and yourself was difficult. You used nicknames so that you wouldn't mispronounce their Arabic names.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it seems as though you're disparaging them, but it's also a form of respect. How did you come up with individual names for people and try to maintain a relationship with them?
Same way you do back here, just, you know, constantly engaging them in dialogue, bridging the gap culturally, you know, finding something as simple as talking about your kids with them, with the sheikhs, with children, would really be a great jumping off point, and then just building a relationship from there.
Mike Scotti, Severe Clear, you mentioned that it's not news, it's not PR, it's not a diary. What is it? Is it a war movie?
No, it's a first-person narrative, and it's really a reflection, and it captures what it's like to be in a war, and that's what I hoped the film did. So, for anybody out there who's wondering what it's like to serve in combat, we hope that this is the platform to kind of realize that.
And when you got home and you saw all the video that was like messed up because of the camera dropping, or you having to basically like throw the camera over your back so the shots just move all over the place, were you disappointed by that footage? Because in fact, when you look at the movie, that's the stuff where the camera's a mess that gives you a sense of the confusion.
Well, it's a testament to the brilliance of Christian Fraga and the filmmakers to be able to take something that was literally a mess and make something that's palatable for the audiences.
Well, severe, clear, uncertainty, chaos, disorder, one account of the war in Iraq. Are you surprised 7 years old today, Mike Scotti?
I feel like I'm 50.
Wow. Matt Gallagher, are you surprised this war is still 7 years old and going on?
Yeah, but it's probably going to be a little while longer for
sure. We'll see you in seven, maybe. Former Army Captain Matt Gallagher, author of Kaboom, Embracing the Suck in a Savage Little War, thinking about Iraq 7 years after the invasion began. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Cuba is accusing the U.S. of trying to destabilize the communist country. That's following a recent ruling that makes it easier for U.S. companies to provide internet services in Cuba. And the government there says that's a threat to Cuban leadership. To explain, we have Michael Voss here from the BBC. He joins us from Havana, Cuba. Good morning. Did we lose Michael from Havana?
Well, we'll try to get him. I should remind people, you heard that conversation with the two soldiers a moment ago, right?
Yes.
I'm talking about Iraq. We have on our website all kinds of materials where you can read an excerpt from Matt Gallagher's book, Kaboom, where he talked about his interactions with the Iraqis. And we're also looking for your takes on the war. What does it feel like in 2010? What does it feel like in your life? You can tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I just want to remind people of that.
On the website is the good place for people to start conversations. I imagine we're going to get some good ones about the war, because we've already been getting a lot of responses about the health care bill as that moves forward. That's coming up for a vote on Sunday. One thing we talked about yesterday was the high cost of care and how people have to make sometimes some really tough choices, trade-offs in what you pay for or what you don't when health care costs become unaffordable.
Philomena from Westchester. Sadly, we bought a house upstate and noticed in short order that the people who appeared to be economically challenged were foregoing dental care. So obviously, that is their choice. I'm not sure what mine would be.
So you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on either health care or the 7th anniversary of the Iraq War. But we do have Michael Voss back from the BBC on the line from Havana. Michael, in what way does the Cuban government accuse the United States of destabilizing their country through the provision of internet services?
I think
we lost Michael again.
Cuban is influencing not only.
Exactly. They're also
services,
messing up with cellular services, maybe, or maybe there's just not some good tower services coming in over the water from Florida. But
well, just the AP story here is
exactly. Let me give you this, the details of exactly what the story is. The United States has passed this ruling. The Treasury Department announced it's going to allow the export of internet communications services, but also software that allow instant messaging, email, and web browsing. That's not just going to go to Cuba, but also to Iran and Sudan and as well.
And the Cubans don't think this is like a great
The Cuban
favor.
People right. do. The right. people, that's the country that has one of the lowest levels of internet penetration in the entire Western
and
Hemisphere.
And the highest levels of literacy in the Western
That's
Hemisphere,
right. Yeah. But the government says that the United States is interfering, that they're just trying to bring their propaganda into the country, and that will therefore destabilize this government. In fact, somebody from the government said this
is a,
Right. They said that this is just showing that the United States is not interested in developing normal communication with Cuba.
There was even an arrest. We actually reported this in the news last week. Alan P. Gross was arrested in Havana for allegedly handing out communications equipment and things that would
allow
you to...
He's been accused of spying,
right.
Actually. The no formal charges have been pressed, but he was accused of spying. He's been jailed. He hasn't had very much access to U.S. officials, and his arrest has been a big factor in the kind of eroding relationship between the United States and Havana, Cuba. And
I imagine Michael Voss is okay.
Yeah. Or his cell phone.
Maybe he was, like, sending an email, and the Cubans said, no, no, no. That probably didn't happen.
Let's really, really hope that that's not true. I hope it's just he ran out of his battery time.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, domesticated dog DNA.
Okay.
And lost Europeans in the deserts of China.
And they're somehow connected?
Right. They're mummies. Indeed. Two interesting science stories for you. The reporter who covered both of them for our partner, The New York Times, will be with us in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama hoping for a vote on health care reform on Sunday, but House Republican leader John Boehner says his party will do everything possible to stop the bill from passing.
Republicans in the House and Senate have worked closely together over the last year, and we're going to continue to work closely together and to do everything that we can do to make sure that this bill never, ever, ever passes.
Today, President Obama makes another effort to rally public support. He'll speak at a university in Virginia. And on the same day, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus announced they would support the health care bill. A bipartisan proposal was unveiled to revamp the nation's immigration system. Possibly some horse trading there. The proposal would require illegal immigrants to admit they broke the law before they could gain legal status and require all U.S. workers to carry a national identity card to prove they are eligible to work.
Israel is coming under increasing international pressure to freeze settlement activity in disputed East Jerusalem. That news comes after a meeting of the Middle East Quartet, which includes the UN, the U.S., the European Union, and Russia. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she's pleased that Israel will enter peace talks.
Our relationship is ongoing. It is deep and broad, and we believe that the launch of the proximity talks is very much in Israel's interests as it is in the interests of the Palestinians.
Secretary of State Clinton has confirmed she'll meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu next week. Finally, at home, gas prices have hit their highest level in 2 years. The average price per gallon is up 19 cents in the past 2 weeks. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So joining us now is Nicholas Wade, science reporter for The New York Times. Good morning, Nicholas.
Good morning.
There were two stories in the paper that I found absolutely irresistible, and both had your byline, and we're going to actually explore both of them in the few minutes we have before the end of the hour. First of all, the picture on the front page of the Science Times, which showed this archaeological find in the middle of the desert in China near the old Silk Road, which was a 4,000-year-old find of European-looking bodies that were perfectly preserved by both the conditions, and they were apparently in some state of mummification, found under some boats. Where did these people come from, and what is the significance of this find?
The people certainly look European. They have sort of brown hair and long noses, but they've become somewhat of a political football because the Uyghur Turks in that area have a separatist movement, and they claim that these mummies were their ancestors, and therefore they had been there long before anyone else, a position which the Chinese government disputed. Well, now a team of Chinese geneticists has looked at the ancient DNA from these mummies and has confirmed that they do have European Y chromosomes. That's passed down the male line. The Y chromosomes come from Europe, and there's a little bit of mixture with people from Siberia, but they probably came into this region of the world, the Xinjiang province, from North, and they are definitely not Chinese.
Hmm. Well, Nicholas Wade, science reporter for our partner in the New York Times, is the author of the book The Faith Instinct. I'm wondering, is there any evidence from what the archaeologists found here of the rituals, of the cultural background of these individuals?
Well, all we have is these rather unusual grave markers, which are enormous phallic poles. That's what the Chinese archaeologists interpret them as. So you're in the middle of this very daunting desert, and up from the sands are sticking these poles. And when you dig down, you find upside down boats. And in these upside down boats is a body in each one. So these are coffins. They're wrapped in cowhide. The dry desert air has perfectly preserved these bodies. And here they are sitting in the middle of a desert in what presumably must have once been a river that passed nearby. But the area is now very dry and desiccated. We don't know what happened to the people. Either they perished or they just moved on.
You know, Nicholas, finding a mystery like this in a world that we think is so, you know, overpopulated and over maybe mapped, there's something invigorating about that, don't you think?
Yes, there is. Now, this is a very inaccessible part of the world. It's surrounded by very high mountains on all sides, and in the middle is this very large desert. It was probably one of the last areas of the world to be inhabited by people.
That's interesting. Well, our second story involves another kind of mystery. It's always certainly been a question of mine as to when dogs became domesticated and where all these breeds came from. And your second story is all about that. And to help us with it, we are joined by Alexandra Horowitz, who studies dog cognition at Barnard College here in New York City. Good morning, Alexandra.
Good morning.
Nicholas, first of all, describe the story.
The story is putting to rest perhaps the question of exactly where in the world dogs were first domesticated. We know they come from wolves, but wolf DNA is kind of sort of hard to distinguish from one region to another because wolves travel a lot. So the last word we had on this was that dogs were domesticated somewhere in East Asia, but that was hard to sort of fit in with the archaeological record because there's no evidence of dogs there until much later, whereas there is in the Near East. So this new study, which uses sort of more refined methods, says that the place in the world where dog DNA and wolf DNA most closely matches is the Near East. So very probably that's where dogs were domesticated.
And the modality, as far as we can tell, is humans selected wolves and then interbred those wolves, and gradually the DNA separated off. What is the distinction between dogs, as we understand them, and wolves from your perspective, Alexandra Horowitz?
There are a lot of strong behavioral differences, and one of the differences that probably wolves self-selected themselves a little before being selected by us and domesticated by us. One of the differences is that wolves are quite fearful of humans, rightly so, and also they don't use eye contact except as a threat, whereas everyone knows that the domesticated dog is more than happy to approach a human, is very tame, and likes to look us in the eyes, which we find quite appealing.
So that clearly is part of the DNA record, selecting out the nice wolves that became the nice doggies who look us in the eye.
Precisely.
And why are there so many breeds? I mean, I can't believe that a Chihuahua is the same species as a Mastiff. Either of you, Nicholas, Alexandra, either one, can you help me with that?
Go ahead.
From the genetic point of view, the researchers have managed to reconstruct this in some detail. So there are a number of breeds selected for function, and they're sort of herding dogs and scent hounds and sight hounds. And then there are some special genes, for example, things that cause a smallness or very short legs. And these special genes have been put into each of these breeds. So within each breed, you have a quite wide variety. That is the essence of how the breeding program seems to have worked.
And Alexander, I gather you're pretty happy that humans started this domestication process 15,000 years ago, or you wouldn't have much to do in your cognition lab, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, and nor would I have a warm puppy in my lap.
Really? What kind?
A mixed breed, as it turns out.
A mixed breed. All right. Alexander Horowitz studies dog cognition at Barnard College, helping us with the DNA record of just when dogs were domesticated about 15,000 years ago, separating from the species of wolves, and helping us with all of that. Nicholas Wade, science reporter for The New York Times. Thanks, Nicholas.
Let me tell you about my buddy. He's 3,000 years old. He's wrapped in bandages and covered in molded debris. My undead mummy and me.
Mummies and dogs. Don't you love that?
Kind of odd to go from warm puppy in your lap to an undead mummy covered in mold.
New York Times does it all the time.
But we've got photos of both on our website, thetakeaway.org. Check it out. You can also check out our coverage of the Iraq War. 7 years into it, we get an inside view from two soldiers, and you can read an excerpt from Matt Gallagher's book, Kaboom, and see a trailer from Mike Scotti's film, Severe Clear. Just stop by thetakeaway.org. And we're looking for your takes on the war. What does it feel like to be used to war now, to be accustomed to being at war? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we've had a huge number of submissions in our Takeaway t-shirt contest. We're making new t-shirts. We're looking for your six-word slogans, and the winners of this contest are going to see those slogans on the t-shirts.
Give the other crooks a chance.
It's still better than John McCain.
The Takeaway almost always gives back.
Go nice submit work. Your own ideas at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Have we done all the web throws? I'm getting yelled at by Jim Colgan, our producer. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.